Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, and I'd like to welcome you to The Green Room, our weekly Life and Arts podcast. This week, I'm casting the pod with Jay Glennie. He's the author of Performance, the 50th anniversary of the Donald Camel and Nicholas Roeg cinematic classic. And to listeners who were there in the 60s and can't quite remember what Performance was, it's a film mixing rock stars and gangsters as swinging London comes to pieces. Written by Donald Camel, directed by Camel with Nicholas Roeg, and starring Mick Jagger as Turner, a reclusive rock star, and James Fox as Chaz, a gangster on the run. Jay Glennie, welcome to Spectator USA.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So how did you come to be making the 50th anniversary tribute to Performance?
I had worked with the producer, Sandy Liebeson, on a previous book on The Man That Fell to Earth. And when I presented him with the large format book for that film, he said we should collaborate on a book for Performance. It was key for me that I wanted to keep the same format, which is large format, many, many unseen images, and then interview as many of the principal cast and crew as possible to tell the story aligned with the images. So I asked Sandy, you know, what did he have in his archives, and he invited me down to his house and just pulled out this treasure trove of archival material covered in sort of dust that had been kept away for many, many years. And I knew then that we had a project. Then it was key to ask Nick back, Nick Roeg, the co-director, and Mick Jagger and James Fox. And delighted to say that all three of them came on board early on and really opened up to me. We had a project. And why now? Because it was the 50th anniversary of them shooting the film. Now, the film wasn't released until 2 years after the shoot, which we can get into a little bit later. But it was key for Sandy that he wanted to celebrate the 50th year of when they actually shot the film, as opposed to when it was released.
It really is an amazing journey into a time and a place. We should probably remind people what the setup of the film is. Can you give us a quick summary of Performance?
Yeah, of course. It centres on the gangsters of London, based around the craze as the reference point. And James Fox's character spoils the equilibrium of the underworld of London and has to go on the run. And he takes refuge with a reclusive rock star who is Mick Jagger. And from there, the film takes a whole different journey.
The supporting cast are an amazing range of people, some of them with professional villains and with connections to the underworld of the day.
Yes. John Binden, who was an associate of the craze. We had David Litvinoff, who was the dialogue coach, bringing a lot of authenticity to the film. He took James Fox down to London and stripped away the Eton schoolboy and turned him into a hard-nosed gangster. Johnny Shannon, he had his acquaintances in the underworld. Young Billy Murray, it was the first film for him, and he was through drama school by the craze. It really did.
I should interrupt at this point and point out that the Cray twins, yes, for American listeners. Could you introduce the craze?
Twins. The twin brothers who basically ruled the East End of London. They owned all the nightclubs, the Vice, and a whole den of iniquity that they owned. And suddenly the aristocracy of the 60s wanted to mix and mingle with them, as did the pop stars. So you now had this huge crossover. David Bailey took the famous picture of them and put them in his book. And there they were alongside the Michael Caines and Terence Stamps and the aristocracy of that time. They really did upset the equilibrium. And many people said that was the reason that they were in prison for so long, for the rest of their life.
Well, that and the murders.
Well, that and the murders, yes.
I suppose the closest American comparison would be to Las Vegas during the time of the Rat Pack, where you have this connection between showbiz glamour, organised crime, and also, in the case of Las Vegas, political connections as well. But London in the 60s is a different story in many ways. It's perhaps less glamorous and much nastier in a way.
Yes.
Would you say so?
Yes. And all, I mean, when I was speaking to Nick, that was and Sandy, all of the what was going on in the 60s. But this went into this huge melting pot. You had the political unrest. Homosexuality had just been legalized. It was a real fag end of the 60s. So all the swinging 60s were coming to an end. And that really did come out in Camel and Rogue's film.
Now, this figure, Donald Camel, you mentioned him there, he seems to be the imagination, in a way, from which this astonishing and still quite alarming film emerges. Tell us about Donald Camel.
Well, he was himself an Eton schoolboy. He's a huge playboy, extremely good-looking, debonair, huge personality. His younger brother, David, was the associate producer on the film, and he spoke lovingly about his brother. He wasn't the nicest of guys at times, by all accounts, by all the people that I've spoken to. Could be very temperamental. Ken Hyman, who was the head of Warner Brothers at the time, he disliked him, Donald Camel, and that for him, that was one of the failures of the film, that he was involved. If he could have had his way, he would have preferred that Nick Rogue would have directed and Donald would have just been writer. I think Donald was too much of a maverick. Previous incarnation of Donald Camel was as a painter, so very solitary, working on his own. And there he was at the helm of a big film company. And as Sandy said, he was also depressive as well. You have all the ups and downs with that as well. And put add to the mix, he also was previously dating Anita Pallenberg, and there she was in his film. And now she's dating Keith Richards, and now she's in bed on screen with Mick Jagger. So you had this huge sexual thing going on as well.
Well, when you describe it like that, it's very hard to imagine anyone but Donald Camel in charge of the production, because it was so much from his imagination, particularly the connection between gangsters, sex, showbiz. This was the world in which he sought out, the world in which he moved.
Yes, yeah, and that's very, very much true, and it's one of the reasons it stayed around and got such longevity. But Hollywood doesn't normally give a man of Donald's ilk the money to just go away and make the film away from any studio contact. They shot the film completely on location, so they had complete freedom. It was Sandy's first film as a producer, Donald's first film as a director, Nick's first film as a director, Mick's first film as an actor. It really was unknown territories for everyone.
And this was 1968, which was the year, of course, that Easy Rider changed the film business.
Yes.
A lot of American listeners probably don't know much about performance. Certainly in Britain, it's become a massive pop culture icon. Would you bracket it with Easy Rider and those generation-changing films, and also the ones that came afterwards?
Yes, for sure. I mean, when I spoke to Mick, he actually said that it was...
That's Sir Mick.
Sorry, Sir Mick Jagger.
Yeah, show some respect.
Sorry, it's the punk credentials in me. When I spoke to Mick, he said that he was very much a big fan. Martin Scorsese was a performance. And you can see that it's influenced his films as well. The music score is a huge influence on many films. Films like, I don't know if our listeners would remember films like Sexy Beast. Mm-hmm. I mean, that wouldn't have existed without performance. And there's a whole ramet of film directors like Guy Ritchie and people like that. But also, as well, as you say, with Easy Rider, that's what makes it so hard to believe that the film studio didn't take a punt and just release the film with groundbreaking films such as Easy Rider already out there. They suddenly got frightened and just hid it away for 2 years, which is remarkable, really. There you've got Mick Jagger starring in his first ever film, and they refused to release it.
Well, it is remarkable. I mean, I one of the wonderful illustrations in the book is the review from a long-lost pop magazine called It. And the review begins, "A heavy, evil film. Don't watch it on acid." I'm not suggesting that the Warner Brothers executives were watching it on acid when they decided to hold it up for 2 years, but it is a heavy and evil film, much more so, say, than Easy Rider, which is a film about how the 60s blew it.
Yes, it is, and apparently much more so. And sadly, with the advent of DVDs and all the extras and we can unearth nowadays, a lot of the supplementary content that was filmed for the performance has long since bit the dust. But the film, the Warners took exception, not so much to the sexual content, surprisingly, because that's obviously very infamous. It was more the violence in the first half of the film, the gangster film part of the film. That's what they took exception to.
Well, that's unusual, isn't it? Because usually Hollywood is all right with violence, especially after the late 60s, and it's still sex that it's much more prurient about.
Yes.
This is the other way around. Why is that? What in particular about the gangster violence was it that they thought they couldn't get over?
The homosexual side of it. Donald was really keen to play up the homosexuality side of it, and the James Fox's character, Chaz, it's implied that he, in when you read the screenplay and you read the two treatments we've also released and alongside the book, there's that element with his nemesis, who Tony Valentine plays, Anthony Valentine plays, who he, don't want to spoil it for your viewers, so I won't tell you what goes on, but that's his nemesis.
I think you can. It's all right.
Okay, who he ends up shooting. And there's a homosexual element to that as well, which they took exception to. So a lot of that backstory with James Fox was cut out.
There was, of course, a big homosexual side to the Cray twins, which was something that they seemed to have been simultaneously quite open about among their friends and extremely sensitive about when it was alluded to by outsiders.
Yes.
This film, presumably in part because of David Litvinoff's information, he was, quote, the director of authenticity on
indeed.
The film. They put all of that onto screen, and didn't Litvinoff had to take to the hills, literally to the hills of North Wales shortly afterwards in order to lie low?
Yes, he did. He took to the hills as part of his long and illustrious career. He upset many people, Mr. Litvinoff. And also you had young Billy Murray, who was put through drama school, as I said, by Ronnie Cray. And one of the first things he did when he read the script was okay with his mentor, because it was evident that the Johnny Shannon character, the head mobster, was homosexual. And so he put it to Ronnie straight away, and he said, boss, that they're there, it's written about you. And the words from Ronnie Cray were, are they taking the piss out of me, son? And Billy said no, and he said, well, there you are then. He had the green light to start in his first movie.
What do you think attracted gangsters to showbiz and show people to gangsters? Because there does seem to be a long-running mutual attraction. It's not just in Britain. It's very strong in America as well.
Mm.
What is it that draws them together?
Well, I think so many of the gangsters own nightclubs, own the entertainment world, and that's where so many of these guys start. With the Krays, a lot of the guys, they owned boxing rings, so they owned a lot of boxers, and now there's a huge cachet with the aristocracy coming along to watch boxing dinners. James Fox spoke of that during our interviews, how many boxing dinners he attended. And that he said that was literally packed to the rafters of, the upper class of Great Britain and the criminals.
And the chaps.
All mixing side by side.
The performances are really quite astonishing. Tell us how James Fox turned himself into Chaz, the gangster.
Yes, I mean, if you look at pictures of James during that period, he was epitomised the young, beautiful hippie. Long hair, lots of tie-dye, and he went down, met Johnny Shannon. Johnny Shannon said to him, no way, son, and literally just threw it all away. He was sent to a chap's barber and had his hair just so. Went to Cecil G, had all his suits made, spent hours and hours living in the boxing ring. He rented an apartment down in that side of London, and literally turned himself into a chap, met many of them. Many of them befriended him and liked him. He really did. And I put it to him as well, how did he rate his performance in performance? And he said it's his greatest performance ever. Yeah, he said he literally had to change himself from an Eton schoolboy and into a gangster, and then from the gangster into a hippie. And it was that arc that really attracted him to the role.
One of the legends about his preparation for the role is that he actually went on jobs with some of the chaps in the evenings.
Yes.
Were you able to establish whether James Fox had witnessed or been party to any illegal activities during the preparation for this role?
Yes, I did ask James. He wasn't forthcoming.
I'm not surprised.
Yes, but a few of the guys I interviewed said that he did. Yeah, he did. He did go out on a few escapades. Billy was telling me a great story of a night out with John Bindon. And for the listeners, John Bindon was a big player in the gangster world who turned himself into an actor by chance when Ken Loach cast him as a gangster in Poor Cow. And he realised that this was an opportunity to actually stay out of prison. So he carried on with his acting career. He then went on to be a bouncer for Led Zeppelin, dated Princess Margaret, and
he had a very famous party trick.
Yes,
I recall.
Yes.
Would you like to share that with the listeners of Spectator USA?
Yes, his appendage was something he was very proud of. He could hang three or four pint glasses off of it, pint mugs.
I'm sure Princess Margaret appreciated that.
Yes, I'm not getting involved in that conversation. But yeah, he went out on a night out, and and Billy was telling me that James was railroaded into going out, and Billy didn't want to go because it was his first film, and he really wanted to concentrate. on the film, but they got railroaded into going out, and Billy ended up leaving early, being the conscientious actor. And when he arrived on set the following day, there was Bindon with a matchbox and kept shaking the matchbox and being pretty antagonistic, bragging about what was in it. And he finally found out there was a chap's thumb in there that he'd bitten off in a fight.
Right, and James Fox changed the direction of his life after making Performance.
Yes.
Not, quite understandably, yes, by the sound of it.
Yes. I did ask James this as well, because he did leave the industry for 10 years, and I didn't know whether it was going to be one of these urban myths, but it was true. But what he did say was his life was already changing track anyhow. He'd started to find a spiritual side, so he'd already started changing track. But yes, Performance was the last performance he gave for 10 years, and when you see the film, it's no wonder.
I'm not surprised. I mean, it is the performance of a lifetime, and
yeah,
it's enough for one lifetime even to see it, I found. But the original script was called The Liars, and then it became The Performers, and then it became Performance.
Yes.
There's a sense all the way through that of people putting it on in the way that gangsters put it on, in a very cinematic way. These are people who've grown up watching George Raft and Jimmy Cagney and so on, and they're dressing the part. And of course, musicians and entertainers put it on as well. Mm. How much was Mick Jagger putting it on?
Well, I asked Mick a very similar question, actually, and because it was his first acting role, and I asked him what the influences were. And there's always been aimed at Mick that he was basically copying Brian Jones. And he said, you know, what you've got to bear in mind, Jay, is that we're all young kids at the time. And I didn't really think about it an awful lot, but there was a little bit of Brian in there. And there was a little bit of Donald in there. And then there was a little bit of myself in there. But from that film, perhaps he was the only non-casualty, because by the time the film was released, the Stones were the biggest, literally the biggest rock band in the world. They'd conquered America. And all these huge tours and records that they were to release. So I think it did influence him, yeah, for sure.
I mean, the notorious orgy scene, another legend attached. I have to ask these questions.
Yes, of course.
This is the history of 20th century culture we're talking here. The legend has it that it was, as Anita Pallenberg said, method acting took place between her and Mick Jagger while filming the sex scene.
Yes, and I thought it was, I wouldn't be doing my duty if I didn't ask Mick that exact question.
I'm very glad to hear it.
Yes. I got his famous sort of laugh, and he said that he'd leave it to legend. He said, I know you're going to do your research and duck mini interviews, and I'll leave it to legend. So, yeah, he wasn't forthcoming either.
I mean, Anita Pallenberg, of course, was with Keith Richards at the time.
Yes, yes. She was, there was a big player within the group, a guy called Groovy Bob.
Oh, but this is Bob Fraser, the art dealer.
You've got it, yes, the big art dealer during that period. And they rented, Anita and Keith rented his apartment. He didn't end up actually moving out, so they effectively just rented a bedroom. So whilst Anita was on the set filming, Keith was still in the apartment with Bob Fraser, who liked playing my games himself. Yeah, so Anita had to keep coming home to a really bad atmosphere, she reported. Keith actually famously said that there was two things Donald Cammell did worthwhile in his life. One was directing Performance, and the other was shooting himself. So there wasn't any love lost between the pair of them.
Yes, he called Cammell a destructive little turd.
Yes, yes. But fast forward to when Warners did actually release the film for the London premiere, Mick didn't turn up with Bianca, but Keith did turn up with Anita.
And he had to watch then this outrageous sex scene.
Yes.
Involving his girlfriend.
Yeah,
this sort of cinematic cuckold.
Yeah, and
really.
his best mate. Yeah.
I mean, it's appalling, really. So Nicholas Roeg said, we did trip over gold making Performance. Mm. How much of it emerged from this spontaneous, druggy chaos? And how much of it emerged from the script and the conception of the film?
Well, when you see the treatments and you see the script, Anita Pallenberg was very, very influential working on the Turner side of the script. But she didn't even know that the gangster part existed. And that's when things were really improvised. When they hit Turner's house, Mike Malloy, the camera operator, he said to me that, you know, we just literally used to take a break. Nick and Donald would go away, think up another idea. Donald had seen a film the previous night. Nick would have read an article, and it all influenced what was going on the screen during that period. So hence why when they started showing the rushes to the Warner's executives, they were showing them hours and hours and hours of footage in their naivety, and Mick hadn't even appeared, so that raised alarm bells. By the time Mick did appear in the rushes, they were horrified.
There is a famous line in the film which says, you know, refers to Luke being 50 years old. I'm going to leave it to you to tell us what it is. It's when the gangster meets the rock star.
Yes, and James Fox says, "You're a funny little geezer. You're a comical geezer. You look funny when you're 50," which is obviously the tagline to the book.
Now, there's two halves to this film, the gangster half and the rock star half. Do you think both of them have aged equally well? Because when I've been watching it, I had the sense that the rock part of it looks very much like a period piece. And the gangster half of it, on the other hand, feels much more alive and much more powerful and considered.
Yes, you could say that. I think it's because we're, as I said before, it's influenced so many films. And for me, it's just felt alive. The first time I ever saw performance, I'd been along to see a film called The Hit, directed by Stephen Frears, which starred John Hurt, Terence Stamp and Tim Roth. And researching the film a little bit more, because I was so enamoured with it, performance was a big influence on The Hit. So I shot away to watch that. And yeah, the first half of the film really resonated with me. The second half of the film, it was playing games with my mind. I then read a little bit about Borges, but all these influences, my initial viewing went over my young head at the time. And I've seen it millions of times, and I still don't fully understand the film. But that, to me, is a Nick Rogue film. I've been fortunate enough to meet Nick on numerous occasions, and working on another project about Nick and that's what his films do. They just deliver up a jigsaw puzzle. And that you have to assemble yourself.
Well, famously, the Maltese Falcon has a glitch in the plot that doesn't quite add up. So if it's good enough for adaptations of Raymond Chandler, then it works as an overall impression.
Yes.
What other influences of performance? Obviously, the whole gangster genre, particularly British gangster films, are just echoes in so many ways of the performance template. Where else do you see the influence?
Well, Nick and Donald didn't actually start forging their friendship through a love of cinema, which to me took me by surprise when I read about it and then I questioned Nick. But when you go into Nick's study, he's literally just festooned with books. That wasn't a huge surprise once I'd seen his study. But yeah, Donald was making a new career in film. I just assumed that being a young guy, he'd be picking Nick's brains about films. It wasn't. It was a love of literature.
One of the amazing things that you turn up in the book is that in the early planning stages, the idea was perhaps to adapt Clockwork Orange. One of the actors named as a possibility was Marlon Brando.
What it was, Sandy was looking to adapt Clockwork Orange for the Rolling Stones. The Marlon Brando side of things, Marlon Brando was actually going to play James Fox's character in The Liars. So The Liars was a concept. They showed it to Marlon. He liked it. They then Donald then went away and adapted it and turned it into Performers with Marlon in mind. So it was going to be Mick and Marlon. When they then represented it to Marlon, he made one of his famous excuses and said, "Not for me." By that time, Donald's first film, Duffy, had been released and forgotten about very quickly. But James Fox had starred in that, and they'd created this friendship. And that's where James came on board.
What was Duffy about?
Duffy was about James Mason.
James Mason?
A billionaire whose two sons...
James Mason is a billionaire in a 60s comedy.
Yes, James Mason. They decide that they want their inheritance a little bit early, so they ask James Coburn to do away with their papa.
Oh.
And it was apparently on paper quite a serious, a film. The studios got hold of it and turned it into a 60s sort of psychedelic vibe film, and it flopped. I've watched it. And
Carnaby Street Caper.
Yeah, it's worth watching, but yeah, it's not going to stay with you.
Well, often those kind of 60s caper films, the most exciting bit is on the soundtrack. The soundtrack of Performance has got a couple of amazing tunes on it, including one of the best lost Rolling Stones tracks from that period, the period of Beggar's Banquet, which is Memo from Turner. What's that one about?
Well, that was, I literally spoke to Mick just as we're almost going to press. I really wanted to get inside of that song in particular. And he was up against it time-wise. Ken Hynam had signed the deal thinking they were going to get a whole Mick Jagger album. In the event, that was never the case. Mick said that he wasn't even meant to sing one song, but Donald came to him and said, look, we want you to sing one song. And he said, what if he thinks that it was pressure from Warner suddenly realising they've got this film and they can't see Mick Jagger singing in it. So he said that Donald helped him come up with the ideas for the lyrics for Memo from Turner. And Keith Richards didn't write it. It was just literally Mick. He that put it to the Stones. And you can find a very bad bootleg of the song. And it's soulless. It's lifeless. Then Mick re-recorded it with the guys from Traffic. And that's the version you see Mick lip-syncing to during the film. And then when they came to record the soundtrack album, Nick, Donald and Jack Nishi, they didn't think it was dirty enough. So they really wanted to dirty it up. So they had Russ Titelman, Ry Cooder come in, Randy Newman, and play it live. Two takes and Memo from
Turner. Yeah, you can hear it. It has that absolute immediate raw power to it. And the great thing about the film, for all the occasional extreme 60s-ness and moments of indulgence, there's a complete honesty to it and a sort of weird reality that comes out in it. Mm. There's very few compromises made with filmmaking, although the use of jump cuts and so on, which cuts against the usual cinematic narrative, which is something Nick Rogue specializes in.
That's right.
It really stands up, and that sound is a hard sound, and it's a hard film in its uncompromising nature, and then also to watch it's hard.
Mm.
What do you think young people make of it? The young, what do they think of it?
Everybody I've spoken to of that younger generation, they love the film. They really do. It crossed all those boundaries. As you said before, it's a lost Stone song, so they've got that involved. Nick Rogue is just a huge icon within the film industry, and it's just grown and grown. As many films that perhaps don't become huge hits upon their release, like a good fine wine, they just take time. And this is definitely in that category. I spoke to many people that have been influenced by the film, and they feature in the book. People like Irvin Welsh, huge fan. Bill Nighy, the actor, he literally knows every word of the script, top to bottom. Paul Schrader, the director and writer, all these guys are huge, huge fans. And then obviously you've got Don Letts from a band. I don't know how the listeners remember Big Audio Dynamite. Their song E=MC² was literally all about Nick Rogue songs and references performance all the way through the songs. William Orbit, the Madonna's producer, he re-recorded Harry Flowers from the soundtrack. So it still resonates today, yes.
Didn't the Happy Mondays do a song, Fat Cyril, I believe? Doesn't that have a performance connection?
Bummed. Their album Bummed was the was all performance. Yes. In fact, Irvin Welsh and Dean Kavanagh, they put on a play at the Edinburgh Festival called Performance about two East End gangsters auditioning for the film Performance, and that was last year. So the film still resonated.
And I think it shall for a long time to come. It's grown into this massive cultural eminence, which is amazing considering that the studio didn't even want to release it at the time. Yeah. Jay Glennie, thank you very much.
No worries, pleasure.
And you've been listening to me, Dominic Green, casting the pod with him, Jay Glennie, on The Green Room, Spectator USA's Life and Arts podcast. You can find us, rate us, and even opinionate us wherever you get your podcasts from, or you can look for us on the iTunes store under Spectator USA. Until next week, thank you for listening, and goodbye.